is trying to cover various techniques which are used in the current cosmology. And the technique I will cover today is it's very recent. It's like, let's say, Signal has been discovered now like 4 years ago. So it's a very recent technique, and it has huge potential. It's really taking over, and it's going to be defined, let's say, the next 10 years are like several massive experiments going on to probe this technique. So it's very important observationally. So it's called bionic acoustic oscillations. And I definitely encourage you to ask as many questions as you want, because I will happily deflect them to Joachim, who is working on this subject. So please ask questions. All right. So, and it's, I'll start by a little summary of what we said yesterday. And so yesterday we talked about dark. I will start by reminding you what we said yesterday about dark energy and standard rulers very, very briefly. Then I'll explain you qualitatively. I won't write many equations, but I just want you to get the right ideas. And actually, the equations are fairly simple. It's all linear physics. So you can, it's harmonic oscillators, linear. So you can write it down. I'll encourage you to look at it. I will just give you the qualitative ideas. And then I'll review the current state of the art, so observations, what we plan to do in the future, and then I will hint at actually complications, because it's never that simple, and then conclude. All right, so dark energy, you know that, we said it yesterday. So it's just basically it's constituent, we don't know what it is, just dominates the current energy budget of the universe. It does cause the accelerated expansion of the universe, and it does also modify the growth of structures. So if you look at structures, if you look at, for example, the amplitude of galaxy clustering on large scale, they grow with time as a function of A. And the fact that you have some dark energy will affect the rate at which they grow. Okay, so that's a linear growth structure, a non-origin. And the most simple explanation, at least let's say, analytical point of view, is just to have a cosmological constant, just to add this one term to the Einstein equations. And then you can fit all this happily. Of course, the problem is that you really don't know how to justify for the amplitude of this one term. But then, at least phenomenologically, you can add this term, and then you can live happily. But because we can understand the amplitude of this term, we try to make up all kind of different models. On whole, we'll have various properties, mostly the equation of state. And I must say, as we said yesterday, so it was discovered using supernovae. But now it has been confirmed on it by other experiments like CMB or galaxy clustering, and really the combination of all these three observational techniques really all support the existence of dark energy at the same amplitude. Okay, so most dark energy models are characterized by their equation of state, which is just the ratio of pression over density, and that fixing the equation of state on this evolution fixes the evolution of the dark energy density as a function of time. Okay, so rho dE. Cosmological constant as W equal minus 1. Most dark energy models have W greater than 1 and a time varying. Okay, and the goal of the goal of any dark energy survey, of all dark energy surveys, is basically to find a time, to observe a time where you can really convince yourself that W is different than minus 1. Then it will tell you that it's not cosmological constant, and then it means that there's some huge physics that we don't understand. So that's really the goal of all these surveys. And so far, if you remember the number I quoted yesterday, so far, current constraints are really close to minus 1, right? So it's like minus 1, it's like minus 1 plus or minus 0.06, okay? So we are very close to minus 1. So whatever it is, it's not very, very different from cosmological constant. Okay, so how do we do that? The way we do it is basically by probing. So there are several ways. The way I talked about yesterday was basically by probing the expansion rate of the universe that we compute through the Friedman equation. So this is a Hubble constant as a function of time, and basically it's related to the density of the sum of the density of all constant terms. Okay, and there are three different approaches to do that. One is a luminosity distance, so measuring it as a function of time, which is just an integral over dA over h with some a powers. And you can do that from luminosity distance. If you have some standard candles, so supernovae, you can measure dL as a function of z. Another technique, which is the one I will focus on today, or at least right now, is angular diameter distance. So and you will use BAO and CMB. And it's, again, it's an integral of 1 over hd, OK? So you're probing this equation as integrated at various redshift. And then another probe will be the growth of structures I just mentioned earlier. And you do that, for example, through clustering, galaxy clustering survey or galaxy lensing survey. And I will cover both of them later, OK? So I will cover clustering dark matter after, and lecture after, and this tomorrow, and lensing tomorrow. OK, so standard rulers. Again, I mentioned that a little bit yesterday. So imagine we have when an object whose length is well known and whose length with time is one, the evolution of this length with time is well known, okay? So you really absolutely, the physical length, you know it in meter. So you can, this object is like 10 to the 5 meter, and I know it, and you know exactly how it evolves with time. Then by, if you measure the angle, if you have some of this object in the sky, you measure the angle at which you see them, theta, and by definition of the angular diameter distance, you can write this angle as a function of this distance, so delta d over dA, okay? And dA is dA scale over 1 plus this, again, an integral over h, okay? Okay, or also, if you, so that gives you the angular side. And reversely, if you know, if you can measure the, if you know, if you have this object, so you can look at it this way, but you can also look at it this way, so you know this length, and you can measure it, its length along the line of sight, okay? You can relate it, and you measure this length in redshift, okay? So it means my object of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 15 meters is just has this redshift span along my line of sight, delta z, then you can relate that to h, onto the proper distance, okay? That's another related technique, okay? So imagine you have that. Then you can, if you have, if you know this distance, then you can, if you can solve for this equation and try to obtain the constituent of the universe, okay? So what kind of rulers would you want to do that, okay? What can, what, if you could choose, what would be the ideal ruler? So what you want is that you want to be able to calibrate your object as a function of time and accurately, okay? You want to be able to measure it over the whole volume of the universe. So not only now, but you want to measure it at a very different redshift, okay? Because you want the redshift evolution. So it's not enough to know that this tick is 2 meters. You want to be able to measure this tick at, you know, 2 meters at redshift 1, redshift 2, etc. Okay? And you want to be able to measure it very precisely. And the level of precision, I mentioned that a little bit yesterday too, is that basically if you want to constrain W to less than 10%, okay, which is already above the current limit at 2 sigma, you need to measure H to better than 1%. So it means that you really need to have this ruler to like sub-percent precision, okay? So it's, you really have to find a very specific type of object that allows you to do that. And how do you find it? So most objects, you know, on cosmological scales won't satisfy this condition. For example, you know, clusters of galaxies. We understand them fairly well. Like, for example, clusters of the galaxy. So there are, I don't know if you know what they are. So there are basically groups of galaxies, 10,000 of them, bound together. It's the most massive visualized objects in the universe. And it's filled with, like, it's basically size is 1 megaparsec. It's filled with like 20% of hot gas that you see in X-ray or you see in Sonnabend-Zeldovich on this massive object, very dense. So you can see also the gravitational lensing effect, so you can measure its mass. You know all kinds of things about this object, and it's very interesting. But there is no way you can know this object and the properties of this object to 1%. Okay? And furthermore, there are a lot of diversity. There are a lot of clusters, like several tens of thousands that we know, but there's some scatter. The diversity is way too big to be able to use dark energy, this kind of method to, you know, to measure dark energy. So now, what you can try to use to find this kind of ruler is that we believe that the law, the assumption between underlying all of this, of course, is that the laws of physics are not changing with time. Okay, laws of physics are exactly the same now as they were at Z of 6,000, Z equal 1,000 at the time of recombination or earlier on. So basically, maybe you can try to find some features arising from physical processes in early universe and map them in the early universe and then at lower redshift. And And you also want to use, basically you want to, you want to use, so you need such a precision that you want to work on scales large enough so that you are basically in a linear regime so that you can compute everything analytically and well, okay? So there's no way you will be able to study objects at the 1% level if you are in a nonlinear regime where you really can't attain this level of accuracy. And so there's one observation that you might have heard of, and I'll talk more about it tomorrow, which is the cosmological microwave background, okay? And here are the most up-to-date observations, and what you see here, so you see the multiple moment, which is basically a Fourier mode, angular Fourier mode over the sky, okay? So it's basically proportional to 1 over theta. You have large scale here, small angular scales here, and this feature here is about 1 degree on the sky, okay? And what you have here is basically what we call the angular power spectrum, and it's basically a power, it gives you a variance or power as a function of angular scale, okay? So basically you can see it as a power in your field as you smooth it at various angular scales, okay? On large scales and small scales. And the remarkable point here is that the data points that you see here, and you see that with error bars, the tiny error bars here, correspond to actual measurement, okay? And so the black one corresponds to the WMAP satellite, and so which is still working, still collecting data. And the other point here with somewhat bigger error bars corresponds to various ground-based measurement of the CMB, okay, at smaller angular scales. And the point here is that, and the pink curve, which is the key part of all this, the pink curve is a best fit model, lambda CDM to this data. And so you see that we have a signal that we know understand very well, that we know to describe very well analytically, because obviously this curve is a very good fit. And we can measure it fairly well. So the question, can we use it to apply this kind of technique? Okay? And so I'll just describe you qualitatively on the key feature you have to keep in mind here is that you see these peaks, okay, in this angular power spectrum, and I will explain you basically what they are very quickly, and I will go more into details tomorrow about the CMB, okay? So basically what's happening here is that at very, very early times, so basically before recombination, so at the Z greater than 1000, the universe is very hot, very dense, and bursts and photons are tightly coupled through Thomson scattering. So you just have a photobaryonic plasma, basically. And it means that the mean free path of your photons is much, much smaller than the size of the horizon. So you can consider this plasma to be a fluid. And you will, if imagine you have some, this plasma is not exactly homogeneous, you will have some slight inhomogeneities, which will come from earlier universe physics. So typically, let's say inflation will set you little all kind of perturbation with a given spectra, and you will see this spectra will evolve in this plasma, and in such a way that basically the density of photons is proportional to the density of baryons, roughly speaking. Okay, because it's a very tightly coupled plasma, and so what's happening is that the perturbations in this photobaryonic fluid will appear in a CMB as fluctuation in temperature, which are just fluctuation in intensity, okay? So fluctuation in the density of photon will appear as fluctuation in intensity, which is temperature. And basically, since the density of photon, is proportional to T4, you will have some, you can write temperature variation as a power one fourth of this photon density. And if you have some, imagine you have a standing wave in this plasma, so a pressure wave, it will write down this way where Cs here is the sound speed. And I will go into more details tomorrow about that. The what you observe in the in your plasma will be this collection of harmonic set by this given sound speed. So you also, if you want to do things properly, you also have to take into account the fact that the photons will be redshifted when they oscillate in these potential wheels, and so this will come will add an extra Doppler term. Okay, and so. I'll do that tomorrow if you don't mind. I'm just want to go through the idea here. I'll go into more details tomorrow. Okay, and so so basically, you have this standing wave, which is as a function of k. So you see this oscillation, and the red curve here will show this density, this Doppler, this velocity perturbation, which are so out of phase factor of pi. And the key point here is that at some point, when the universe recombines, so when the universe is cold enough, so the universe is expanding, is cooling off, and when it's cold enough so that the first atoms form, okay, so suddenly the mean free path of your photons become as large as the horizon. So there's no interaction anymore between your photons and the atoms. And so there's a quick, relatively quick decoupling between photons and baryons. And so it means that this the baryon oscillation will be frozen in time, okay? Which is, and this is what you will see when you observe the CMB. And so the important part here is that a given K mode, so in 3D, at the time of recombination, will project in the sky. You will see it as having an angular size given by, so given wavelength lambda, you will see it on the sky as a angular scale defined related to the physical scale by this dA here, okay, which is what we are trying to measure. So if you know this quantity, if you know this wave mode precisely, you can measure theta and you can measure dA precisely, okay, or you do that from multiple in Fourier space, okay. And so basically, what the acoustic oscillation is, that's what's happening in the CMB, and that's what's fixing this acoustic scales in the CMB. On the first feature you see here, it's the first compression peak, compression wavelength in your plasma, which is smaller than the size of the horizon. Okay, the second peak will be the first radiofraction peak, and this throw here will be the first velocity maximum. And so, what you observe here is a set of harmonic modes. So there is a damping, but I'll explain that tomorrow. You see, obviously, the first peak is much bigger than the other, so there is some damping going on here, but that's another phenomena. But the key thing here is that you have a very clearly defined set of features which are set by the properties of your harmonic oscillators at the time of recombination. So, and as you remember from the CMB, the perturbations are extremely small, right? So you observe, if you look at the sky, the CMB variations I'm talking about are basically in amplitude of 10 to minus 5. So it means that you're well qualified to compute all of this in a linear regime. So you can have a very precise computation of this feature, and this is what is represented by the pink curve here, where it's all in a linear regime. So you know to compute this extremely accurately. Okay, and actually, so if you try to So what the key physical quantity here is basically the sun horizon, which is the distance by which, like an acoustic wave, had time to propagate at the time of recombination. And so this is a physical quantity, which is extremely, because of the features I just described, is extremely well measured. Okay, so you measure it to with this kind of accuracy, so you are well below the percent level I was requiring before to measure the dark energy properties. Okay, and so this sun horizon is the one quantity that fixes exactly the position of the sky of this various feature. Okay, and this is, and you know to compute it from first principle, and you can measure it extremely well. And this will be one of your standard rulers. So it will be one of the standard rulers that you see at the time of recombination, so which is at redshift of 1,000. Okay, now CMB, it's a very challenging experiment. And it's, you have to observe in a millimeter wavelength, you have to go through the atmosphere, you have to, you're looking for extremely small temperature variation. So it's a very difficult business. So one question you can ask is there any remnant of this acoustic phenomena at, in a lower redshift universe? Okay, for example, in galaxy power spectra. So that's, a, and so could you use this, will there be any sign, any remnant of this acoustic scale in the distribution of matter at lower redshift, okay? And basically, are there baryonic oscillations, again, in the density of dark matter that you observe at lower redshift? And when you think about it, it's not totally absurd, right? Because baryons, so baryons constitute about 15% of the matter part of the matter and content of the universe, okay? So you have, so 50% of, so the perturbations you have in the baryon density will affect to some extent the matter, the dark matter perturbations, and so, and actually will lead to a small, so a set of small oscillations in a matter of power spectra. But now you are not looking, you will, but there will be, you know that it will be smaller because of, because whereas before we're looking at sort of, we're looking at the temperature, so at the photon perturbations, now we're looking at the, what we are probing is that we're probing dark matter perturbations, but we're probing the effect of baryonic perturbation on this matter, on matter perturbation. So you have, you will have, because there are much less baryons on dark matter, you have a natural damping of the effect, which is of order, you know, 10%, 15%. So you, you expect to have a much smaller effect than you have in the CMB, but still there should be a remnant of this acoustic phenomena. And this is basically, if you compute things again in the linear regime, that's how it looks. So you have, you recognize in the radiation here, the CMB, that's what I just discussed. And if you project it in the matter perturbations, that's what you expect to see, okay, as a function of the 3D wave number. So which is a Fourier mode in three-dimensional Fourier mode. And here is a matter power spectrum as a function of scale. And you see what you see here, you see again, you see a remnant of this, the perturbation that you saw earlier in the CMB, okay? And if you try to factorize, if you derive the I will, if you factorize out the overall shape of your power spectra, which is set by other effects that we'll describe in the next lecture. Basically, you see the variation in the power spectrum as a function of scale, and you see these oscillations of about, you know, 10%, okay? And the scale of interest is k of 0.08 h per megaparsec, which is about 140 megaparsec. So it's, if you, so one cluster is about 1 megaparsec. Let's one galaxy cluster is about 1 megaparsec. The average spacing between clusters is about 60 megaparsec. So it's like basically every, it's a wavelength that is more or less equivalent to the size between two clusters. You can, two galaxy clusters. So it's a very large wavelength, but you, that if you can measure it, then you should be able to see this kind of a phenomenon, okay? So if you know switch, it's sometimes convenient to not to look, I was showing you power spectra, so in Fourier domain so far, but it's somewhat convenient for measurement purposes, also visualization, to go to configuration space or real space, okay? So it's just, I'm going back, I have this power spectrum, I'm converting back to a correlation function in real space, which is just this, this transformation here. And and what the way it translates into the function of, so I'm measuring here, I'm measuring the average correlations between 2 points separated by, let's say, 80 megaparsec or 100 megaparsec. And the way I measure that is that I have a density field, my matter density field, and I measure all kind of pairs separated by this. Look at objects separated by this distance, and I measure their, I average their correlation. And this is basically, the kind of signal I should expect with a bump here, which comes from this, which comes from this harmonic phenomena. So because I have a set of harmonic peaks in a Fourier domain, when I go Fourier transform back to real space, it will translate into a, let's say, well-defined scale. So, and the broadening of the scale is due to just to other physical effects. But basically, the key point is that you have a well-defined scale that you would like to see in your correlation function. Okay. So, how can I now? Let's give you a more, let's say, if we stay in real space, and like, let me give you a more visual way to look at this perturbation. So imagine we have a, so we start again from this, before recombination, and we have a, just one mode. I'm just looking at, I have one dark matter potential wheel, okay, right in the middle of the, right in the middle of the, of the plot here, and here I'm showing the baryon density and the photon density. And right in the middle, so I have an excess of baryon and excess of photon, which on which this excess is created by the fact that I have just a dark matter potential wheel right in the middle. So now if I evolve, and you see this peak, and here you have two colors. You have a red curve for photons, blue curve for baryon, and initially they are just exactly superposed. And this is, so this is way before recombination, so photon baryons are really tightly coupled. So they are, they follow each other. So you have, of course, as I start to evolve the system, this overdensity will create a pressure wave that will propagate outside, right, at nearly the speed of light. And that's what you see here, okay? And you see this scale is moving, but you see that both baryon and photons evolve simultaneously, okay? There is this one mode evolving. This one, you see, it's just expanding. Okay. Now, at some point, so when the universe recombines, so when the first atoms fall, suddenly this coupling between baryon and photon will stop, and so my where the photons will keep propagating, the baryons will stall and stay here, okay, basically. And which is, so you have baryons here, and yes, you have baryons and photons. And what you see here, suddenly you start to have this decoupling between these two waves propagating, and where the pressure, the photons keep propagating, so that basically all the, it's, the photon density is smearing out slowly, okay, the baryonic features, so the baryonic over density stay here, stay put, and doesn't evolve much anymore. Sorry? Well, basically because of the sound speed totally, the sound speed goes to zero almost instantaneously at the time of recombination. So there is no radiative pressure anymore to push the baryons. The sound speed goes to zero.
Yeah.
That's right. So, and while the photons keep propagating slowly, there's no mechanism anymore to push this baryonic wave. So it stays exactly, it stays stalled. It just stalls and stays basically at the same. The same scale, okay? And
so can I also use this to start this like recombination process?
Yes. So, sorry, what's that
again? I mean, using the baryon acoustic oscillations to talk the
recombination. That's right. That's right. So I'm just giving one picture here to so the CMB would be just a way to do that. If you do the full treatment for the CMB, it would be just a way to solve that properly. And so the CMB will be very sensitive to the detail of recombination. So exactly how long the recombination was, what were the involved process, the detail of the process involved, you will be able to infer that from this detailed study of the CMB, yes. Okay, and so if you keep going, so what you see, if you evolve further in time, you see that the perturbations in the photons has almost totally, is almost totally gone, but the perturbation in the baryons is still there, okay? And what you see is an interesting phenomenon, is that you see that actually you see some features coming back at you see some features, some density increasing again at the origin, where my, and the reason for that is that basically I still have the, all this was basically was started with a dark matter potential well in the middle, and so as the baryons don't have any more radiative pressure to push them away, suddenly the dark matter starts to attract them again, so that there's some, so there's some baryons going back to, towards my center dark matter potential well, and which is what you see here, okay? And at the end of the day, let's say at lower redshift, you end up with this kind of features where you see you have some dark matter perturbation that when you have some dark matter, some baryons that went back to the dark matter perturbation, and you have, but you still have some remnant of this acoustic phenomena. So this is for one wave, one wavelength. In practice, you'll have, you have a superposition of waves, so you have to do a more careful treatment. But this is just to give you a qualitative idea of what's going on, okay? And so the key point here is that you, the key point here is that if you look at the baryon density, so let's say if you look at the distribution of galaxies, in principle, you should be able to see a remnant of this acoustic oscillation that you see very well in the CMB at the scale which is basically given by 100 megaparsec, okay? And so, and this is all linear physics again, so it's a very solid predictions. And it's, for any model with a non-zero baryonic density will have this. And once you have calibrated, once you know the CMB, once you measure the CMB, which we do very well, we have done now, we, like for example, the first peak, we'll never know it better than we already know it, right? Because of statistical errors. You can calibrate exactly the scale, and then you can predict what, where the scale should appear in the, in your measurement of galaxy clustering, okay? So it's, you can make a very precise prediction, which is, of course, it's a, always a very satisfying thing to do as a, as a, in science, right? So you can predict that given the CMB and given my understanding of the linear evolution of the constituent involved, so baryon dark matter, I should be able to see an excess correlation at this scale, okay, which is 140 megaparsec, typically. And also a satisfying thing about this, baryonic oscillation is the fact that they are actually, it's a, it gives you a very sharp feature in your correlation function, which is also a satisfying thing when you want to measure something, because it's much simpler to, it's much better to, when you know you are looking for a feature in your correlation function, it's easier to measure than if you have, let's say, a power law, okay? So you can devise the fact that you have some shape information about the signal, it helps you to devise the right statistical estimator to pick up this signal, okay? So the, having a sharp feature is actually something helpful in terms of measurement, okay? Now, an interesting thing with also with this, that basically, if you let's say imagine you have several several ways of measuring this baryonic scale, baryonic acoustic oscillation at various redshifts, okay? Then you could make some all kind of consistency check. So for example, from one, you can infer what DA is from one, and you can infer from one redshift what the matter density or baryon density or dark energy is, and then from that you can predict what the next one should be, and you can so and you can add up this constraint, which will allow you to do all kind of consistency tests. And basically, you, the point is that using this technique and using this well, using this well-defined feature, you expect to measure to have sub-percent measurement of H using linear theory and basic cosmology. Okay, linear theory and just global properties of the metric. Okay, and so again, just to that's a more or less what I just showed. And so how do we do that in practice? Okay, how do we measure this? How do we measure this scale in practice? So what you want is you want to find a tracer of the mass density of the dark matter field, and you want to compute its two-point function. Okay, that's the first thing you want to do. So you want to find let's say, so it will be galaxies in practice. So you want to find the right type of galaxy that will allow you to trace. So the underlying hypothesis will be that galaxies trace the dark matter perturbations. Okay, and so you will look at galaxies and you will measure. You will make an hypothesis to relate their distribution to the dark matter distribution, and then you will look for feature in their correlation function. Okay, and you relate this, the position of this feature. You will relate that to the sun horizon. And you will measure the angular scale of this function, and then from that you can infer dA, and from that you can infer the cosmological parameters. Okay, and you also compare that to the CMB which you already have measured. The only problem, of course, is that actually it's the scale you are interested in is actually very, very large. So I'm talking about, I mentioned 140 megaparsec or such. And so it's actually, it means that you need a lot, very, very large volume, a lot of the objects, very deep in redshift to be able to do that. And for example, this was the state of the art in terms of galaxy survey in late 80s, okay? So the Gehler-Hoekstra, the CFA, two redshift survey. And what you see here, like it's a slice, so you observe galaxies in some kind of pencil, and you project them into this pie, and what you have here is redshift in unit of CZ, and each dot is a galaxy, okay? And that's, and you see some clustering, you see some structure. It's not uniform, but the key point here is that if you wanted to use this survey, so which was again just state of the art, like let's say 15 years ago. You will have a very hard time measuring the BAO effect, the Baryonic-Akostikalis oscillation, because it's much too small, right? So the scale of the BAO would be this red line here. So there is no way you can measure using this sample. You can measure, have a good sampling of this wavelength. Okay. So you want to. It was not possible. It was. People thought that this could be hit, but this could be present, but this wasn't feasible till recently. And this became feasible with basically the Sloan, latest generation would be the Sloan Digital Sky Survey that you see here, and 2DF, 2-degree field telescope, which are both telescope specially built to make efficient and deep galaxy surveys. So not necessarily, they were not necessarily built to measure BAOs, but they were built at least to measure, to have a great sample of galaxy over a large volume of the sky to fairly deep redshift. So basically, for example, the mean redshift for the Sloan Digital Sky Survey is about 0.7, I think, for LRGs. And it's basically observing one quarter of the sky, okay, 10,000 square degree. Okay, so it's a very, and it has been operating for several years continuously. And this instrument does only, is only a survey instrument, so it really does this one thing all the time. Okay, so that's what it takes to make this kind of measurement. And it turned out actually using this data set, people were able, so it was mostly Eisenstein and collaborator and the Sloan collaborations, were able to actually see with some significance this baryonic oscillation scale in the correlation function of the galaxies. The black points against same plot, so it's correlation function as a function of scale, of the separation in megaparsec. The black points here are the measurement, and you see this little excess here, which appears exactly where you would expect this excess of the Baryonic scale to appear at about 100 megaparsec. And so far. That's a detection of the feature, but it's not a strong enough. It's a detection, so fairly firm detection, but it's not strong enough to really learn a lot about dark energy using this technique, right? So it's not precise enough yet. But But it was exciting enough because, first, as I said earlier, this is a prediction again, so it's always a satisfying thing. This was predicted well before it was observed, so it's a very satisfying thing. But it was promising enough so that people decided to build more ambitious surveys and try to improve this measurement and to really learn about dark energy using baryonic acoustical oscillations. So here are state of the art. So the measurement I showed you was using the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and used only 46,000 galaxies. Okay, so it's a very for some technical reason I won't really detail. You can take all the galaxies you observe. You want a subsample which has some, let's say, homogeneous properties. So you want galaxy of one type only to probe this. And basically the volume they probed is 0.7 gigaparsec cube. Okay. So as you can imagine, the bigger the volume, the better, because it gives you more sample of this particular wavelengths you are trying to measure. Okay. And so another competing survey was a Sloan, the 2DF galaxy survey, which is much more galaxies but in a smaller volume. Okay, so, but they both have, let's say, comparable accuracy in terms of measurement of this scale. So both are the 5% level of the measurement of VA. And then there are, later on, this analysis was refined by Panamanaman collaborator using the same data set but with more powerful analysis. As basically, they were allowed to have a bigger volume, more galaxies, but this time there is no. There were one important fact when you try to measure this, where you try to make this measurement, is actually you need to know the redshift. Not only you need to know the sky position of the object, you also need to know its redshift, okay? Because you are interested in the 3D power spectrum, and so you want to be able to reconstruct the 3D position. And so you want some fairly high accuracy in your redshift, because if you have too much errors, imagine you are measuring objects and you are measuring their position this way, but also this way, and if you have too much inaccuracy in your redshift, your information along the line set will smear out your signal. So that's basic physics here, basic property here. And so, whereas these guys use extremely good redshift information using the spectrum of each galaxy. So for each galaxy, we measure the spectrum. So when you have a spectrum, you have lines, so you can measure the redshift, so you have a very good position measurement. This analysis used a less, more flexible but less precise redshift measurement, which is using not this time the spectrum, but just various imaging at various frequencies. Let's say five colors only, and from these five colors, you try to infer the redshift position. And so, even though they have more galaxies, a bigger volume, you see that their precision is not that much bigger as the original one. And this comes from the fact that basically the redshift sensitivity is 1,000 times worse in this case. Okay, and these are so all first. Various analyses were performed, basically reanalysis of these two data sets. Okay, so that was the statuses now. And so the current, if you combine all of those measurements and try to plot the BAO, that's what you observe here. Okay, this blue point on the red curve is a best fit model. And you see that you clearly see the oscillation with good significance, but you see that the error bars are still quite big, right? Now, if you go back to the contour plots, the one I showed you yesterday, on what you have here, so now you assume a flat cosmology and you try to interpret, to use this measurement, so this wiggles in the power spectra to try to learn about dA, and from that to learn about the equation set of dark energy. Is that the type of constraints you have? Okay, so the black contours, black and gray, are the one I showed yesterday, which come from supernovae only. And you have, again, you have a strong degeneracy here, which tells you that if you use supernovae only, you, for example, you can't separate this point here and this point here will make similar predictions. So you can't distinguish them. Okay, so that's severe degeneracy in terms of, that's omega matter, that's W. Now, if you combine them with BAO, with the measurement I just gave you, basically you are able to, because you are probing not dL, but dA, the degeneracy will not be identical, and so you are able to break this degeneracy, okay? And so the BAO only will have constraints this way, and by combining the two, you're able to set up your constraint at this accuracy, in this point in the parameter space, okay? So again, it's interesting to remark that the combination of various techniques, various distance measurement techniques, allows you to greatly enhance your constraint on any single parameters, okay? So the combination of various techniques allow you to break the degeneracy that affects every single cosmological probes. Now, basically what we want now is, so what's the next step? That's where we are nowadays. What's the next step? Basically, you want more precise measurement of this scale to better constraint dark energy. And you need much more than what, in terms of volume, you want bigger volume to have more sample of this scale, and you want more galaxies to have, again, better measurement of this correlation function. And you want to be able to control systematic errors, which I won't really get into, but basically you want millions of galaxies, several gigaparsec cube. Okay, so that's what you want. And that's a little technical. So basically what's going to happen now is that you have, so there are surveys already going on. So Netta was mentioning one yesterday. So there is a Sloan 3 digital sky survey, or there's a Bose survey, for example, which are using the same facilities, but now really optimized to do this kind of measurement. And what's a, you expect, you expect an improvement. I think you expect to go factor of a few in terms of distance measurement. So you expect to be at the 1% level I mentioned before with them. So this is happening now. It means that you will be, the data will be analyzed in a few years. Okay. So within 3-4 years, you'll be at the 1% measurement where you want to be. So if you look now at 10% from now, there's various surveys being planned. On one is, for example, the LSST. It's a large-scale synoptic telescope, which will be a very large telescope. And it's a very big project that should be able to do this measurement very well, and it should be, funding is still a bit uncertain, but it should allow you to do this baryonic acousticosine very well by looking at basically the full sky, okay, up to a redshift of 1 on 1.5. And you will have basically all the galaxies up to 1 on 1.5. And using this kind of survey, which is it's a tremendous experiment in terms of logistic technology, and this is the kind of constraint you expect. So this time, I'm not looking at, so far I was assuming all the results I showed you were assuming a constant equation of state, so W equal constant of the function of time. And now what you do is that you consider that the equation of state goes like, so you allow for a linear evolution of the equation of state as a function of scale factor A, and you try to constrain, now you are accurate enough that, and you are able to separate your galaxy sample enough redshift bins so that you can measure both W0 and WA. And these are the constraints you have here, W0 and WA. So if WA equals 0, you have no evolution, and the cosmological constant will be the point right here, right? And so you see that with this, using these techniques, actually you have to look at the blue curves here, those contours, you expect basically 10%, a little more than 10% on W0, but on 20% on WA. Okay, so it's a great improvement as compared to where we are now. And this is, again, this is going to happen in, let's say, 10 years from now, if you are a little bit optimistic. Not 10 years, I think it's realistic, yeah. 10 years. And so just this is just to tell you that there are tremendous amount of resources which are really allocated and dedicated to this kind of survey. So it's really going to be very important in the near future. So unfortunately, I presented you the overall picture, and I present you as idealistic pictures. Of course, there will be real life effects that you will have to worry about. If you, the more accurate you want to be, the more careful you have to be in your analysis, and there are various effects that you will have to take into account, and it won't be, it's not, none of them are exactly trivial. First, as I said earlier, all the measurements so far, and so for the CMB or for the current measurement, everything is done using linear theory, right? So it's perturbation are small, you can go to first order in perturbation theory, linear theory, and it works really well. Now, if you want to do nonlinear corrections, okay, so second order and higher in the density field becomes at this level, like if you want to go to sub-percent, you start to worry about this effect. And this is nonlinear, so it's to handle that analytically is actually very difficult. There are a lot of kind of techniques to do that, but it's actually not, it's a very difficult business, and it's not clear that it's actually, so far it's not clear that we know how to do it analytically at all to the required accuracy. So what people do is that you do that through what we call n-body simulation. So where you create huge simulations with billions and millions of particles, and you, for each particle basically being a galaxy or the mass of a galaxy, and you evolve them through time, putting gravity and as much physics as you want, and you try to make precise predictions, and you try to quantify if, and if you solve for, you can solve in this simulation, you can solve gravity exactly, and so you can compute naturally the matter power spectrum in the nonlinear regime, so you can quantify this effect, but to do that properly, it's a really tricky business, and so far it's not clear we know how to do it at the right level. Okay. Also, I mentioned that so the underlying assumption is that you look at galaxies. Galaxies are baryons. Okay. But so what you have is that you look at galaxies, you look at baryons, and you try to infer the dark matter or the total matter density field from that, or under the density power spectra. And so you have to have a well-established relation between the galaxy and the matter. And so this usually is. What we call the relation between the two is usually called a bias. Okay, so what is usually assumed that the galaxy over density is a linear function of the dark matter over density, and this is, well, this is true in large scale in a linear regime. Now, it's true, but it's not exactly true. And again, nonlinear effects will complicate this relation. So you have to evaluate. You have to be very careful when you look at your modeling of the relation between galaxy and dark matter that you use to infer this constraint. Okay. And also, I mentioned redshifts before. Again, you also have to, and this is all this is complicated by the fact that you don't, when you look at galaxies, you don't observe x, y, z, right? What you observe is that you observe x, y, or let's say angle on the sky, and then you observe a redshift, okay? And redshift is just a measurement of the velocity, so which is like you have the expansion, okay, then like the Hubble flow, and then you have also peculiar velocities, which are like the, none of the galaxies are static, right? So they are moving, they have their own velocity, and so, and velocities, if they are in a linear regime, again, you know to handle them, you know to compute them, and you know their statistical properties. But when you go to the nonlinear regime, it becomes again much more difficult. So you have to. All this is. We think we can do it, but it's still a work in progress. So this is our. So the picture I showed before might be a little bit idealistic, but still we think to do it. We know to do it. And so, for example, if you imagine you look at just look at this plot, right? So the same plot as before, correlation function as a function of scale. The blue curve is using linear perturbation theory only, and the red curve is using a set of measurement based on n-body simulations, so which include full nonlinear effects. And you see that the nonlinearity tends to smear out the structures. And so if you try to infer, you can see qualitatively that if you try to measure this scale at the 1% level, right, like if you want to measure this peak at the 1% level, you do have to worry about these effects, right, which are as important. And so, and this is a, there's a lot of work going on here. So this is just to tell you that it's not going to be as easy as we, as I might have said. Okay, so the conclusion for this lecture. So baryonic acoustic oscillation provide robust and tested standard ruler, and it has been predicted and observed. It allows to constrain properties of dark energy through the measure of dA. And you can combine, you can do that at both higher redshift, so the Z of 1000 using the CMB, or at low redshift using galaxy surveys, so redshift of 1 or 2, okay, 0.5, 1, 2 typically. And there's much more to come, especially at low Z. I know, but there are all kinds of questions we need to address. And one is how to relate, how do we relate that to, how do we relate galaxy and dark matter in linear regime, nonlinear regime? And so, and there are all kinds of limitations you need to worry about. And so I'll stop here. Now, next survey, I'll tell you a little, next hour, I'll tell you a little more about galaxy clustering and dark matter perturbation and how they look. Okay. Thank you.